This year's Bevier lecturer is Richard Epstein, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, the James Parker Hall Distinguished Professor of Law Emeritus at the University of Chicago, and the Peter and Kristen Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. Finding a new superlative to describe Richard's career, intellect, and scholarly contributions is no easy task. He is one of the most influential legal scholars of the past half century. But his scholarly approach is different from that of other influential legal figures, such as Richard Posner, Guido Calabresi, or Ronald Dworkin, who pioneered law and. The starting point for those scholars came after the and, whether it be economics, history, or philosophy. Richard's work begins with law, but that makes it no less perceptive and indeed has produced insights that the external perspective would not. For example, Richard did the seemingly impossible by providing a coherent explanation of the doctrine of unconscionability in contract law. Many contracts teachers had dismissed the rule as a lawless exercise in judicial self-indulgence. But Richard showed that we need only step back from the moralizing language and see the rule functions as a means of policing deals that in all probability were the product of a flawed bargaining process, but one unlikely to generate direct evidence of fraud, duress, or incompetence. Seen this way, the doctrine is entirely sensible, and this is the type of conclusion that could be drawn only by someone deeply immersed in the law and in the ancillary doctrines of fraud, duress, and so on. Those of us who work in financial regulation owe Richard a great debt for his work on simple rules. He has brilliantly and persuasively turned on its head the progressive idea that we must abandon the supposedly outmoded rules of private law in order to manage an intricate modern economy. Instead, in Richard's telling, the basic rules of private law do a better job than detailed regulations at mediating the disputes generated by a complex economy. While he has written on a vast array of substantive areas, Richard is perhaps best known for his work on property and in particular on takings. As befits his libertarian leanings, he casts a skeptical eye on the notion that the takings clause provides a narrow right to compensation when the entire bundle of sticks comprising a property right has been removed from the owner. Instead, he sees the takings clause as part of a normative principle of limited government. Richard's book on takings has been so widely discussed that there would seem to be little more to say than this. You have arrived as a scholar when Joe Biden brandishes your book at a Supreme Court nomination hearing, in this case Justice Thomas's, and insists that the nominee disavow it to demonstrate his fitness for office. Whatever Richard has to say about property rights is well worth our attention, and I look forward to hearing his lecture today. Please join me in welcoming Richard Epstein.
Oh, they do have me a bottle of water. Well, first of all, let me thank you all for coming to this lecture. I find it especially gratifying that so many old friends are here, including colleagues both from the University of Chicago and elsewhere. That's the sign, I think, of the kind of respect that you hope to earn by toiling anonymously in the vineyards. I also see a fair number of my former students here, including Lee Lieberman Otis, who came from Washington, to which I say thank you. And, of course, I'd like to thank Lily for making all this possible in some kind of but-for causation way. And the interesting point, of course, about this is when I thought about Lily, I said, when did I first meet her know about her? And it's the time runneth not, so it's like a statute of limitations question. I really do not remember the first time that I actually met her or knew her. It seems to have been there, at least since she entered into the career. And in fact, last night she gave me the startling revelation that a piece that I had been written by a guy named Bill Baxter, a very great economist, and some young anonymous lady who disappeared from the profession, Lillian Altree, turns out to be none other than Lillian Bevere before her marriage, right? And it's amazing, you know. I said, I've always read that article. I always thought it was profoundly wrong in certain particular ways, but in effect it kind of shows just how ubiquitous and important the scholar Lillian has been. Last night we had dinner together, this morning we had breakfast together, and one of the things about Lillian is she earns my undying respect because she never pulls a punch. And one of the things you could tell about a great scholar is that you always understand them. They may be wrong, but they're always clear, and you're great because you're right more often than you're wrong. Now, if I only remembered the topic that I was supposed to speak about today, I would be quite happy to give you a very fine lecture on it. I think it has something to do with public deliberation and its relationship with property rights, and in fact, it ties into what Paul Mahoney, another old friend, has said. It's part of my question, lifelong career, trying to figure out how it is that we defend the older classical liberal version of understanding the interaction between property rights and public deliberation as against the more modern versions that are associated with the rise and, I hope, fall of the modern administrative state. And so essentially what I'm going to try and do is to sort of set out what I think the two basic models are and then show it as they cohere or don't cohere, and then try to explain how it is that you can start to choose between them. Well, essentially, the modern view of the modern administrative state starts with the notion that deliberative democracy is itself a strong positive good. And the way the system tends to work is that you gather all of the stakeholders, that is, those people who have an economic interest in the outcome of particular situations, find some way in which you can have a legislative hearing of some sort or another or an administrative procedure, take in all the views as to what the preference functions of the various parties are. And then what you do is you turn all of this stuff over to a collection of experts who will translate the preferences of the group as expressed in their collective deliberation through a series of technical rules that essentially will start to manage and organize the particular economy. And the system here displays very consciously an earlier system which saw a much more modest role for the state in the way in which it was to organize social affairs. The basic institution under the other systems turned out to be the system of private property, which gave strong rights to individuals or small numbers of individuals as co-owners to the exclusive possession of property, the rights of its use, the rights of its development, and the rights of its transferability. And what happens with this particular system is that those compact rights then start to interact one with another, and through a combination of development and trade, what you do is you try to expand the size of the social pie, where the state is important, A, to enforce the contracts and to police the boundary conditions amongst the various parties. And then the question is how it is that one wants to reconcile a system which talks about deliberation with one that talks about private property rights. And the first thing that one wants to do is to understand that the good on each of these systems has its bad Achilles heel. So that when you start talking about this situation, it's not as though there's a dogmatic insistence that every libertarian position that I've ever embraced is necessarily and internally true. Rather, the opposition is really quite the sense, which is extreme versions which have basically no public deliberation and all property rights, or the other extreme version that has all public deliberation and no property rights. It doesn't matter which corner you go to, there's going to be something wrong deeply with both of them. So in order to do this, what you first have to do is to find out what the defects are as to each of these two systems considered in isolation, and then to try to figure out a methodology that will allow you, under the circumstances, to figure out how you minimize the sum of the errors from the mixture that you adopt to take you into a middle position. I hope you recognize that this is kind of what you might call an abstract empirical inquiry. It's not as though I sit down with a bunch of economists and generate a set of numbers. It's essentially the situation that I've looked at various kinds of social institutions since I started in this teaching business back in 1968. I've seen some of them succeed and many of them fail, and that the kind of empiricism that you're doing is to gather from these odd bits and pieces and your general knowledge of theory some way in which you can value the two things to work well. So let's start first with the defects associated with deliberation. Well, for one thing, the first question you always have to ask with respect to deliberation is who is it that is going to be able to participate in the deliberation in question? One always talks quite confidently about the set of stakeholders that are involved, but their identification may in fact be a source of great controversy. And so either you have a system of open admission into the deliberation which becomes chaotic, or you try to have some degree of exclusivity with respect to the deliberation at which point the exclusion conditions can become extremely arbitrary. In addition, when you start to do some form of deliberation, you're going to have to figure out, first, what are the rules of deliberation that are going to take place? These are not self-evident. It cannot be that everybody's entitled to speak as long as they want on anything that they have to do. Somebody has to come up with the rules that are coherent with respect to the way in which this particular deliberation works. And then, in effect, once you have deliberation, if you don't get unanimous consensus, which you never do when you have this broad class of stakeholders present, you're going to have some kind of a decision rule and ask yourself whether you work by simple majority on the one hand or whether you require supermajority on the other. And again, you've got two Achilles heels associated with this. If it turns out you use a simple majority rule, the minority in this particular deliberation may come out very badly and feel deeply aggrieved, and yet if deliberation is the final be-all and end-all, it will have no protection. On the other hand, if you try to increase the situation so you have supermajorities, it could result in paralysis, or if you get agreement, it could result, in fact, in the exploitation of tiny, or as we sometimes say, discrete and insular minorities, who in fact are going to be overwhelmed by the general populace that you have. All of this costs a great deal of money. All of this costs a great deal of time to do, and it could well be that as long as you deliberate, it will happen, as my father used to tell me long ago, if you deliberate long enough, the decision that you make at the end of the day, even if you make the best decision, is in fact going to be worse than the worst decision if you had decided something a bit more promptly. It turns out that the corrosive effect of time and cost on deliberation is something that one always has to consider. So that's going to push you to the other end and say, aha, these guys with private property really got it right. But of course, there are serious difficulties associated with this particular scheme. If, in fact, you allow people to deliberate when they have private rights, there's always going to be the question of what are going to be the external effects of their private deliberation on those individuals who are not party to it. And in some cases, it will be positively pernicious. We can have a private deliberation amongst a bunch of thieves, and the only question is who it is that they wish to target by way of their aggression. And we certainly don't want that. We don't want private deliberation that allows pollution to continue. So you have to worry about the boundary conditions. And in effect, when you start to do this kind of sort of private type situations, the question as to whether or not the impacts on other individuals not party to the deliberation, when multiplied over countless such private situations, these things can often have negative effects themselves. Now, I hope from the way in which I've described this that in general, I think if you're trying to figure out which is likely to be the largest set of dislocations, they will come from massive collective deliberations. So the question then is how is it that you merge these things together in order to get something that looks like a coherent whole? And here, I think, is a technique that one needs to use. And generally speaking, trying to figure out how it is that you put public institutions together out of whole cloth is almost always a danger, unless you have some particular metric by which you can evaluate these things, and for that you need to develop some particular methodology. And the methodology that I have often worked with respect to this is what I like to call the single owner theory. And what happens is if you start looking at a whole variety of private developments, they start with private property owned by a single person. But in fact, the impulse to get gains from trade or such, that what happens is that the private owner is somebody who now tries to create some kind of collectivity with larger numbers of individuals in them. And then the question is exactly how do you do this, and what mix of deliberation, what mix of common property, what mix of private property do these people play? Well, the first thing to note is why is this a perfectly sensible kind of methodology to use? It's because, essentially, if in fact you're talking about this development and only its internal position, everything that is done by the single owner before he starts to sell things off will have consequences that are personally perfectly internalized to this party and captured more or less by the price system. So, for example, if you decide that you want to create strong private rights for individuals and hope to maximize your situation, if it turns out that you try to sell these lots and all of the people who are trying to get into them discover to their horror that they have perfect private property, but there are no common streets inside the development, so they can't leave their own houses and make it out to the streets at large, you're not going to be able to sell a lot of units if, in fact, they become prisons. So what you then try to do is to say, okay, what we really have to do is we have to include some kind of common elements in these, and then the issue is how far do you go? Well, it's the same sort of marginal calculations that you always make. You take something away from the private holdings under the SETI, and you put them into this public area. But the natural tendency that you have under the circumstances is to essentially try to equate at the margin so that the last dollar that you sacrifice from the private holdings is compensated by the last dollar that you earn when, in fact, you put these kind of common facilities in there. And the key thing to understand about this is it's the trade-off mechanism with the internal stuff which essentially allows you to reach an internal equilibrium as between these two things without having to do any kind of external calculation of the sort that all many forms of public deliberation starts to prod. Well, then, in effect, what you have to do is to figure out, okay, well, we need to do this stuff. What do we do next? Well, you have to figure out how you configure and organize the various units. So to take one common theme in modern land use law, it is widely understood that people actually care about the views that they have from their property, even if their views over somebody else's property. And one can go back to the origins of the zoning laws and so forth and see that height restrictions intended to protect views were something that made their way into constitutional discourse as early as 1908, a case called Wells against Swayze, Peckham deciding it in favor of state power. And again, it's exactly the same game. You can decide we really would like to protect the views of one person in the middle of this unit, and then nobody else can build around it, so you have 1,000 potential plots of land. You've got one unit and 990 vacant plots of land. Not going to be so good. So what you then do is trade off at the margins again. So what you do is you design the piece, you figure out which views are most valuable, which ones are not, and if it turns out, you'll see that oftentimes what happens is there's a kind of a gentle gradient so that the people in the back can see a little bit over the people at the front, but not entirely. And what they've done, in effect, is try to maximize the sum of the values associated with views on the one hand and with the occupation of space on the other. And they may get it wrong. Everybody may get it wrong. But at least you see yourself having an incentive structure, the purpose of which is to essentially figure out how it is that you maximize the total value of the units, taking into account all the soft externalities, including those which the law of nuisance, at least in its common law instantiation, tries not to take into account because it's simply too difficult to do. So now you've got yourself another little kind of incentive structure. But then what you have to do is you're going to figure these things out. You have to divide these units and sell them all off. And it's just going to be a virtual impossibility that every unit you're going to sell is going to have exactly the same value, so you're going to have to start putting prices on these sorts of things. And what you'll discover is that some people will have a larger stake in the common development than other people will have in that particular common development. And then the question you then have to ask is exactly how is that difference going to be reflected in the governance structure that you tried to put into place with respect to these situations. And generally speaking, what happens is there is going to be at least a short sort of preference saying that, in effect, those people who have a larger stake in the building will have a larger say in the building. But at the same point, those people with the larger say will, generally speaking, have to bear a larger burden with respect to their collective decisions. So what you tend to do with respect to these things is to create a mechanism where essentially you develop something I've yet to talk about, which is critical for all public and private spaces, a kind of a non-discrimination rule, and that rule says, in effect, we all contribute the same amount in taxes, and what happens is when you start to coming to the talk about the division of public gains, you try to do it proportionate to the amount that you put in so as to prevent people from being able to lobby very hard to make sure that somebody else in the division pays a larger share of the cost than their units would otherwise do, because that kind of conflict creates uncertainty, and that kind of uncertainty reduces the value of the shares or of the units that are being put into place at the time of the original arrangements. So it's not as though you have all private property rights, but you do try to find a way to stabilize the way in which the public property rights in this particular units are organized so as to prevent that kind of factional intrigue. And that, of course, immediately starts to tell you that the faction issue, which we talk about in private developments, is surely going to become an extremely important issue when we start to organize the way in which we put public bodies together. And so then what you do is you have to sort of figure out the next question, which is exactly what is it that we deliberate over and why do we do it? And it turns out that the well-organized community does not allow you to deliberate over everything that is put into the situation. So commonly, we are allowed to deliberate and to decide collectively with the proper voting rule and the proper structure of deliberation exactly how you organize the private spaces. But generally speaking, if Mahoney has the unit next to me, we are not going to allow by majority will me to persuade my fellow owners of the condominium that his property ought to be condemned for 10 cents and transferred to me. What we do, in effect, is we have a system of the rules on deliberation in which certain things are protected against deliberation, other things are subject to deliberation, and the things that are protected against deliberation turn out to be the strong property rights. If they're going to be taken at all, and that's very doubtful under most of these settings, it's going to have to be for a just compensation figure. Otherwise, the ability to get something at below market rates introduces that destructive side of the political intrigue, which from the ex-ante perspective will reduce everything. So then what you start to do is, what about the allocation inside these particular units? And one of the things that you discover is generally the collectivity will be indifferent to the way in which the families organize their households inside the business. It is a general theorem of corporate law, which is reflected here, that the smaller the organization, the more unique the divisions can turn out to be, because you've got all sorts of elements of trust and common dealing, which essentially allow you to do very sophisticated arrangements which are non pro rata. But the moment you get into the public space, all of a sudden you realize that those things are absolutely deadly. So if you start looking at this in terms of the, for example, the corporate structure, small corporations, as the dean will tell you, have incredibly complicated corporate structures reflecting the age of the senior partner, his son, his daughter, other people in there with all sorts of buyout agreements. Whereas the moment you get the public corporations with anonymous individuals, you get a single class of shares that are freely tradable, precisely because nobody can take into account those differences. So that what happens is, in dealing with strangers, you want relatively standardized rules. When dealing with friends, you can have highly individuated rules. What applies in the corporate setting also applies with respect to the condominium setting. And so now you have this. And then, of course, what you have to do is finally put into place a governance structure. That government structure will essentially determine through deliberation the way in which you operate the common elements of the situation, but will not be able to determine by deliberation what you do when people own units and you'd like to get them out. There's just a lot of prohibition. So what you really are doing in this case is you create an elaborate and highly instructive mixture of strong property rules, non-discrimination rules, public deliberation rules, and it turns out that the exact mix of those will depend upon the nature of the facility that's going to be involved. As a rough rule of thumb, if you're talking about an old age home, what you will do is find more intensive public services and you'll have a larger public space, as it were. If you're talking about condominiums, essentially of people who are professionals, you're going to have fewer services of that sort and you will have a smaller governance state. So all of this stuff tends to work out relatively well by equilibrium, and exactly the same thing happens with respect to the corporations. Now, one thing to notice about this is that the deliberation takes place under rules that, generally speaking, reflect Robert's Rules of Order and do not have any explicit market mechanism associated with their operation. So it's not as though when you go to a condominium meeting or a corporation meeting or even to a faculty meeting, somebody raises his hand and Mahoney looks at this clock and says, well, now I'm selling 1 minute of time for $15 to the faculty member who wants to use it, and I'm taking bids from so forth to see the way in which it's allocated. So the question is, why don't we use bids under these circumstances? Because it turns out there are subtle externality problems that the bidding system only aggravates. The point of collective deliberation is that people who are not speaking have the benefit of listening to those people who are speaking. So the benefit of any speech is not simply captured by the people who are allowed to talk. It turns out if you improve the quality of deliberations, it's captured by the people who listen. To give essentially a price system which goes to one party of the relationship and ignores everybody else is to systematically skew the way in which the discourse takes place. So that in fact, when we're dealing with discourse, the market mechanisms that develop this condominium or this law school structure or this corporation structure revert to non-market mechanisms with respect to the allocation of this particular good. Now, how do we know that all this stuff is pretty good when we do it in the private sphere? And the answer to that question is pretty straightforward. There are a lot of condominium associations out there. There are a lot of planned unit developments out there. It turns out that essentially the basic theorem is this: as the value of real estate starts to go up, the ability to have separate parts of land becomes very, very costly, and the way in which you try to economize is to create common elements that are shared by other individuals. And if it turns out that you can organize those common elements efficiently, essentially whatever inconvenience you suffer from this particular arrangement is more than offset by the price situation. So So the thing to understand about this system when you're working it in the private sector is you get yourself the mixed solution, and every single tendency that you have with respect to the rules is towards stabilization of the system at large. Somebody wants to push the boat too far in one direction, the value losses are essentially internalized by everybody, either in their use value or the potential exchange value, so these things, by and large, start to go pretty much back to the center. Sometimes these restrictions are very elaborate, like on aesthetic-type arrangements, but if you've got the system of governance right and you've got the preferences of the individual in there right, one of the ways in which you control for the difficulties is by having sales rules of one kind or another. The people who tend to congregate in a particular building, knowing what the plans and the governance structure are, tend to have preferences that tend to converge. As those preferences tend to converge, the deliberation problems become a little easier than they are when you're dealing with a large government where essentially everything is thrown into a random situation. Now, when we come to the governance side of the situation, it turns out that the single feature that makes the private system work so well is no longer present. And that's the notion that you have a single owner who can dole out all those rights and can perfectly internalize at the outset the pluses and minuses of various kinds of institutional arrangements. We are a stubborn, we are a heterogeneous lot, we have very large property of the populations. It turns out that we don't all agree with each other on a very large number of situations. And so then the question is, how does that start to reflect upon the relationship of property rights on the one hand and deliberation on the other? Well, the position that I take on this particular question is that deliberation is a magnifier. If it turns out you've got yourself a good system of property rights that has been organized, public deliberation will actually improve the way in which you work. But if it turns out that you've got yourself a bad system of property rights out there, what deliberation will do will only make matters worse than might otherwise have been the case. And in order to understand how this works, let me just start with a very simple situation. So I want you to do basically a flight of fancy and imagination, and imagine that the new community that we're talking about is a tic-tac-toe board with 9 squares. And that 8 of these scales around the periphery are all developed, and there's one in the middle, which is essentially at this point undeveloped, but has a discrete market value. And then ask yourself about how the deliberations are going to work, dependent upon the kinds of property rights systems that we put into place. If you take, in fact, the classical view with respect to takings, what happens is any diminution in the bundle of rights that comes from a restriction on use is essentially a fully compensable event. So what the takings law does is it tracks the private law. And if it turns out the 8 guys at the edge do not have some kind of restrictive covenant with respect to the development for which they would have to pay, they are now essentially in a position of strangers, and if they want to shut this fellow down, they have to pay him for whatever interest they want to take from him. Now, what does that do by way of the deliberation? Well, if you look at the guys on the outside, many of them might say it is really quite wonderful that the densities in this particular neighborhood are a little bit reduced because there are only 8 of us and there's not this 9th guy annoying us in the middle. And it also is really quite wonderful if we look over this guy's land and that it turns out that we get more light in there than would otherwise be the case. So what we'd like to do is to sort of take this stuff over. But you've got this just compensation requirement, which is very pesky. And so when they start looking at this thing, the question that they then have to ask is, whatever it is that we take, we have to pay for. So what we have to do is to figure out whether or not it's worth doing. Now, collective deliberation, in fact, is quite useful to the extent that what it does is it allows the 8 people on the outside to coordinate their behavior so you don't get the kind of intrigue that happens if only 6 people are willing to do something and the other thing are either trying to hold out or to free ride. So let's assume that these guys can make it coherent amongst themselves and act as though they're a single person who sits on the outside of this kind of an arrangement. Well, what they're going to do, in effect, is engage in marginal analysis exactly the way they would if they were dealing with the single owner and the development. And they will start to look and they say, you know, we keep this thing absolutely empty, and we can give you what a benefit schedule is for us, and say, you know, we gain $1,000. But then on the other hand, they have to look and say, well, this guy has got development rights with respect to that plot of land. He is subject to the same constraints that we are, whether they be by the law of nuisance or any other kind of public code that has been consistently applied. And he's now going to have $5,000 worth of losses by virtue of the loss of these particular rights. Well, what are these people going to do? They can count from 1,000 to 5,000, and if in fact they have to pay the market value, under these circumstances for the loss of development rights, they won't do it. Then what we have to do is to check ourselves as to whether or not this private decision they make under this constraint is socially desirable. And it turns out, since there are no externalities put into the place, the net $4,000 in loss from the hypothetical that I've given you suggests that from a social perspective, you don't want to do this thing either. Because what you're doing is taking into account all the externalities, positive and negative, from the decision, because the just compensation formula essentially uses the price mechanism against government in exactly the same way that the developer who has the single plot necessarily internalizes the cost by having losses of revenue from one and gains from revenue to another. So if, in fact, you've now allowed deliberation to take place at the periphery, what's going to happen is it's going to really help. People will start talking about one another and asking themselves whether or not we really can find $5,000 worth of benefit. And some very ingenious fellow may be able to figure all of this out, propose it to the other. And so if the equation, in fact, is there's $10,000 worth of benefit, not just $1,000 worth of benefit, the deliberators will, in fact, impose that decision upon the other person. And indeed, even if you allow the guy in the middle to join in on the vote, he's going to be very hard-pressed to oppose this situation, because unless he wants to play dog in the manger with a holdout game, he is essentially left as well off with the money as he would have been otherwise. And indeed, one of the functions of the just compensation clause is to make sure that you get fair value of the property taken, but to eliminate the holdout problem, which would create its own kinds of bargaining disruptions. So the situation seems to work pretty well. But now let's suppose what we do is we change the rules associated with this. And what we say, in effect, is so long as the land has any kind of residual value to its current owner, if, in fact, future development rights are either eliminated or cut back, no compensation is owing under the circumstances. And let's assume further that the guy in the middle is fully entitled to participate in the deliberation with respect to this particular event. Well, what's going to happen? They'll sit there and deliberate. The guy in the middle says, you know, you're wiping me out. You're getting something for $5,000, for $1,000, which is worth $5,000 to me, and so forth. Now, in effect, it's even worse than that. You don't have to pay me anything at all, because I still can make whatever use of the property I made without the development beforehand. And the moment he tells them, you know what's really happening, you've engaged in this moral outrage because you've now garnered huge benefits for yourself, right? And nothing for me, to say, isn't that a terrific idea? We are all self-interested individuals, and now what the deliberation will do will, in effect, allow the neighborhood to decide that aggressive government action at a zero price is a social benefit, and they'll say, after all, just do an election. You got eight people who are in favor, one person who's an event, you got supermajority votes in this particular case. Everything turns out to be hunky-dory. So the basic maxim that one gets out of all of this is that the deliberative structure has itself deep externalities built into it, unless and until you have the strong property rights frictions, which will drive you in the correct direction with respect to the way in which it goes. Now, just to sort of finish this thing up, what I would like to do and to suggest to you before we go to the question is that this peculiarly dangerous mixture of deliberation coupled by technical expertise, in fact, can play very, very dangerous roles in a whole variety of situations where, in fact, the externalities through deliberation are systematically ignored. And let me give you the two examples that I think best illustrate this, and they're drawn from real-life examples during this absolutely critical period of the American Revolution, which is the period between the rise of the Wilson administration in 1913 and, in fact, the end of the basic second term of the Roosevelt administration, say, roughly around 1940. And the first thing to note about this is that Wilson was always a guy who thought that we could find clever ways to exempt some individuals from general rules that apply to others. And one of the neglected but exceedingly important positions of the 1914 Clayton Act was Section 6, which said that labor is not an article of commerce, and so therefore it turns out to be exempt from the antitrust laws. I would have thought if you were not an article of commerce, you couldn't sell anything at all, but that's not the definition they use. And then they did exactly the same thing for agricultural and horticultural societies. So now, in effect, what happens is they're going to allow these guys to get together in some extent in order to deliberate amongst themselves. And what they can do is they can set themselves a cartel price. Now, it's difficult under these circumstances to do this because there are a lot of people and they tend to be somewhat disorganized. So if you want to get this deliberation to work, what you have to do is to make sure that the holdouts and the cheaters, in effect, are not going to stop things. So if you now fast forward another 20 years, they've figured this stuff out, that exemptions from the antitrust laws are worth a little but not a whole of a lot. What you really need to do is to get everybody to join in, everybody. And so what they do is they devise a scheme which will essentially allow for collective deliberation and market partition so as to make sure that the dream of the cartel can be fully and permanently realized. Now, how do you do this? Well, what you do, in effect, is you start to pass the Agricultural Adjustment Act starting around 1933 and going through 1938. And what you do is you create a mechanism. Now, I'm sure all of you have read Wickard and Filburn, the great case talking about the scope of the commerce power. But in fact, that's only one of the two issues that was involved in the decision. The other issue had to do with the question of how the election that was being conducted under the Agricultural Adjustment Act should have been respected in virtue of the fact that there was some lobbying by an assistant secretary of agriculture to try to get people to move this way on the quotas and that way not. And what Justice Jackson said is, you know, we're running one of these elections. If we allow these kinds of claims to set the thing aside, we'll never get the whole process done. So the election stands. So essentially what they did, in effect, is they had an election in which all farmers could participate, but nobody else. And then what they did is through that election, they had an argument to decide what the size of the total output would be. And they, of course, would all deliberate with great precision, trying to figure out what the optimal size of the crop was in order to maximize the monopoly profits which they would get from the operation of this system. Then once you do that, what you have to do is decide how to allocate it. And everybody understands that if you leave this to the same kind of deliberative process, it would be a ridiculous free-for-all. So what happens is the Secretary of the Agriculture is now empowered to make the allocation first by state, then by county, and then by Roscoe Filburn's farm. And if he exceeds his quota, it turns out that he has made a major offense. Now, what is this? This is the world's perfect cartel, right? I mean, you can organize and massage these things. And you say, well, what's the big deal? It's only a monopoly. Well, it's not only a monopoly. The fundamental theorem of labor and industrial organization is that cartels at their best are as efficient as monopoly, but in most cases, they're vastly more inefficient because they have internal distributional constraints, which means that they cannot put forward their most efficient producers because if they do so, they'll lose the political coalition that kept them together. So what you do with OPEC and what you do, in fact, with the Agricultural Adjustment Act is you tell each person what his quota is, and people who find it very difficult to produce will nonetheless do so long as the market price exceeds the quota price, even though, in fact, it's an efficient kind of allocation. Now, when you try to figure out what the social costs of this particular situation are, note that the pattern of deliberation that we have excludes consumers of all sorts, kinds, and spirits. Now, what you then try to do is to figure out whether there are any costs associated with this. When I did some work on public health regulation in the 1930s, there actually turned out to be a fair number of studies which trace the level of caloric content that is lost by virtue of the creation of the monopoly position in the grain industry, the milk industry, and anything else that the Roosevelt administration was able to cartelize through collective kinds of actions. What was the judicial response to all of this? Well, it was one of rational basis deference, most notably captured in the decision of Nebbia against New York, which says, you know, this is a really very complicated thing, and so long as you got this wonderful form of deliberation, who are we to strike this thing down? We will just let the whole thing fly. And so what happens is the courts, not understanding the peril of the situation, decided that these transactions were, quote unquote, affected with the public interest. The net effect of that was a famous inversion. What happens is that the old doctrine of affected with the public interest allowed classical liberal judges to make sure that public utilities with monopoly power could not collect it, and now the new version is it allows you to form cartels, in fact, which allow you to get super competitive products. This is very easy. There's no risk of confiscation, right, when you're trying to create monopoly rents for a given group, so you give complete deference to the overall situation. I regard this as a tragedy. The labor situation is essentially the same, because what it does is use exactly the same two-part situation. What we first do is we realize that the exemptions that you get with respect to the Clayton Act are not sufficient to allow for strong union organization. Firms will stay out of this situation. And in fact, what really happens, and there's a great case called Duplex and Deering, which shows this from 1921, is that you will find that if three firms in an industry are unionized and the fourth one is not, before the passage of the Labor Act, those three firms say to the other, we will throw off these union contracts because we can't compete with the ununionized firm. You better organize a secondary boycott so as to bring those guys into the fold. This is, I think, clear evidence of the fact that if the union structure were more efficient, what you'd say about the non-unionized guy, go right ahead, you're no competitive, we can produce at lower cost than you do. But the result was exactly the opposite. So they had to worry about the leakage just as they did in the agricultural cases. And with the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, they did just that. They create a system of monopoly unionization. That means that if you get the majority of workers in a particular unit to vote for you, it becomes the exclusive representative. It can then figure out how it sets terms. There are no pro rata requirements as there are with respect to the condominium. So in the early years of the statute, the epic battles between the trade guys on the one hand, specializing in particular crafts, and the broad-based CIO stuff was in fact very intense. Indeed, although I did not know it at the time, that the CIO became a really powerful organization just 3 or 4 months after the NLRA was signed, precisely because they now realized, given the changes in the bargaining structure, they had a real chance to win all these kinds of elections. So there's a risk of minority expropriation, and there are also the same old externality problems that you have. These cartels are very inefficient in the way in which they organize themselves, so that work rules become part of the puzzle. If you doubt that, just read the recent Wall Street Journal article where they tell you about the 465 pages of work rules that apply with respect to BART, which means that technologies like electron email is essentially banned so that people can write everything in by paper in order to keep the positions in question. These costs are not small. They turn out to be absolutely huge. And, of course, the strike threat, which shuts everything else down, would, under the antitrust law, be regarded as a collective refusal to deal, which would be a per se crime. Now it turns out it's perfectly legal. And in order to have 2,000 workers gain a couple hundred dollars or $1,000 in the course of a year, you're willing to impose, as, quote, incidental damages, millions upon millions of losses upon hundreds of thousands of consumers in these cases. How much can the rents go? Well, that depends on the strength of the monopoly. In industrial unions today, they don't get much of a premium because it's too easy to enter. In specialized markets, you do. The Carnegie Hall strike amongst the stagehands, there were 5 guys that shut down the place. Their average salary was $420,000 per year, and they were essentially electricians, property men, and carpenters, right? Just a little bit above the market wage. So there is nothing you can say in the abstract that will tell you what the strength of the monopoly is. What you can say with complete confidence is that the whole structure, which depends upon this mixture of deliberation and administrative assistance, is going to be bad if the underlying property rights structures are bad. And this is a case in which the progressive movement essentially uses deliberation, excludes individuals, creates huge externalities, which essentially continue to bedevil us to the very day. And let me just end on this particular note. One of the ways in which you can talk about the success or failure of deliberation depends upon the durability of the changes that you start to introduce. And you go back to the New Deal. 1937, there was a debate over industry structure, and there was also a debate about the size of the public funds that ought to be spent on civilian works and things like that. By 1940, all the transfer payment issues were essentially solved by the war. And on the other hand, all the stuff about the Agricultural Adjustment Act, about the Motor Vehicle Act, about the National Labor Relations Act, these things turn out to have half-lives that are 20, 50, or 100 times longer than the specialty program. So when you start to put this stuff in, you can't sort of treat these things as something that is easily changed and removed. They are not only monopolies, they are durable monopolies. And once somebody has the inside track on the legislation, you have to enormous political force to overturn them. And generally speaking, most of those battles start to fail until the industry is so inefficient that it crumbles from within, as arguably happened with respect to the CAB. And so essentially, we can talk about mixed solutions with respect to these cases. But the maxim that you learn from the private sector explains everything you need to know about the public sector. The private sector mixed deliberations models and property right models work because the single owner drives you in that direction. If you had a strong takings clause which imitated that, you would see more of this in the public sector. But since we have a series of courts, which now seems to treat it as a sacred creed, that mere economic regulation by the state is utterly devoid of constitutional constraint, we are now reaping the whirlwind. The sad thing to say is that the intensity of these losses does not diminish with respect to time. And in the current situation where we have a strongly progressive administration, and indeed the word progressive has made a comeback in the last 5 years, what happens is these are non-wasting assets or non-wasting liabilities, and we find ourselves worse off than we've ever been before. So beware of deliberation. Beware of mistakes of property rights. It turns out you got to do the whole thing correct, and the only way you're going to be able to do that is to pay very serious attention to first principles. Thank you.